From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
As director of the long-running Australian election study, Ian McAllister has overseen many opinion polls. The survey, run by the Australian National University, asks a wide range of questions about voters' political opinions and has been conducted after each election since 1987. In this podcast, Ian McAllister joins us to talk about voters and issues at the May election. Ian McAllister, you've undertaken research on elections now for three decades. How do you think this one will differ to others?
Well, all elections are different to some extent. I think this one will probably be different for perhaps three reasons. One is we've seen a lot of leadership change over the last 5 or 6 years. So it's certainly the case, based on our surveys, that voters are not really happy with these constant leadership changes. So it'll be, to some extent, a test of the political parties and what people think of these various changes. Secondly, it's an interesting election because perhaps for the first time since 1993, one of the major political parties has put forward a series of very constructive policies. So they've been very clear about what they're going to do if they're elected. And that's something that we haven't really seen for about perhaps over 20 years or so. And the third thing that makes this election a bit different is that we've got a very high level of distrust in the major political parties. So we see the lowest level of trust in politicians we've seen since the 1975 dismissal, based on the surveys we've run. So again, a major test of the political parties and the leaders.
Now, taxation will obviously be one of the central issues at this poll. But you've made the interesting argument, and I quote, that the new battleground on tax is people's assets, not their income. Could you just elaborate on this? And how much do you think policy differences between the major parties on assets, such as franking credits and negative gearing, will sway voters?
Well, what we've seen perhaps over the last 15 years or so is that the major political parties have broadly agreed that people's income tax should be lowered. So there's been a general consensus that direct taxation should be a lot lower than it is at the present time. The dilemma that the political parties have is that because of the increasing complexity of government, the wide range of policies they're putting forward, they need to raise a lot more tax to fund those. And that's not just the case for Labour, it's also the case for the coalition. The net effect of that is that political parties and governments are now looking to people's assets to try and tax those assets, to regulate them. And what we've seen is that the Labour Party's put forward a range of policies, but we also saw in the 2016 election that the coalition put forward a series of policies to restrict people's ability to put money into superannuation, which was at that time relatively untaxed. So what we're seeing is quite a significant shift away from direct taxation to indirect taxation. Now, the background to this is that in Australia, we've got internationally quite exceptionally high levels of direct share ownership. So we find in the various surveys that have been run, our surveys, but also the Australian Stock Exchange, that round about half or more of people have got direct investment in the share market. We've also got one of the highest levels of investment in property, which we don't find in a lot of other countries, certainly in the major advanced democracies. And we've also got very high levels of investment in superannuation. So there is a lot of money sitting in economic assets that people own. And this is the battleground now for the political parties in terms of taxation policy.
And we know that, of course, Labor is tackling this directly at this election, franking credits issue and negative gearing crackdown there. Do you think this will be a vote changer?
It could potentially be a vote changer. The various government official figures that are put forward show that round about 8, 9, perhaps 10% of people have things like investment properties or would be affected by negative gearing changes like that or franking credits. What we find in our surveys is a larger proportion of people report investment properties, membership of self-managed superannuation funds. And what's happening there is that certainly the official membership of these various groups probably is about 8 or 9 or 10%. But within families, family groups, there would be somebody who would own self-managed super fund, but it would also indirectly affect other people within the family. So the potential proportion of people who are affected by these changes is actually really quite high. And what we find in the 2016 election, when we did a bit of research on this, and we looked at the effect of the coalition's changes of superannuation policy on the electorate, we find quite a significant effect, not just on people that owned superannuation funds, but also people who are indirectly affected. And we also find an effect for people aged in their 50s and onwards who were not directly affected. They were not pensioners, but there were people who were thinking about retiring and thinking about planning for retirement. So the potential pool of people that's affected is really much larger than the parties argue.
And this goes across voting cohorts, does it? Because a lot of Labour voters, for example, would have interests in superannuation funds and maybe in direct shareholdings too.
Yes, that's exactly right. And again, what we find in our surveys, particularly in 2016, is a significant minority of the people who say they own self-managed super funds and also investment properties tend to be people in blue-collar occupations. A lot of them are people that work in trades, plumbers, things like that, construction workers, nurses, teachers.
And we hear a lot of this from the government. They nurses and policemen.
It's absolutely true. I mean, we see that in the surveys. So these are not necessarily very rich people, and they're people who perhaps don't have a lot of job benefits. They're on casual contracts or something like that. And this is how they're investing and saving for superannuation. So it is going to affect a lot of people. I mean, I think the Labour Party is probably right that a disproportionate number of these people are concentrated in coalition electorates. But potentially this can have a very significant effect on the outcome of the election.
And do you think particularly the crackdown on cash refunds from franking credits, is that something that will really bite, because people in retirement are pretty sensitive to the losses of even modest amounts of cash?
Yes, and what we saw in the 2016 election, one of the most significant factors which almost led the coalition to losing the election was the changes to superannuation, because that did affect a lot of older voters, and a lot of them simply didn't vote for the coalition based on that. So something similar could very much happen today, and we find in the surveys around about 7 or 8% of people would be affected by franking credits.
You've also said that this is, quote again, almost a generational election. Is it that the electorate is engaged in a young versus old political battle?
Well, we've seen generational influences taking shape over the last two or three elections. We've seen it in the surveys. There's been a real emerging generational gap in the patterns of voting, with younger people tending to vote Green or Labour, older people tending to vote for the coalition. A bit of that tended to break down in 2016 because of the coalition's changes to superannuation, so they did lose a bit of support among people aged over 60 or 65. But what we see in the surveys is that younger people are much more focused on things like moral issues. So, for example, same-sex marriage was a major issue, brought a lot of younger people into the electorate. And for older people, superannuation, assets, things like that are the things that they are particularly concerned about. But it probably also is worth mentioning that younger people, for example, we find in the surveys, particularly aged in their 30s, tend to have less trust in the political system. We've seen that change over the last four or five election studies. When we drill down into that, we find that it's people at that age who are starting to build families, buy homes and so on, find it very tough to get into the housing market. And a lot of that is driving distrust. So I think the changes to assets, broader changes in terms of moral versus economic issues, a lot of these are reinforcing generational conflicts within the electorate.
We're hearing in this election a great deal of talk about high-profile independents, especially centre-right independents in safe Liberal seats. How do you think that this is going to actually translate into results, or do you think these people are going to mostly fall short?
Well, I think certainly in the House of Representatives, there's a very significant barrier to people not within the major political parties getting elected, because it's essentially a majoritarian electoral system. So that is very tough. They don't have the workers on the ground who are going to campaign for them and things like that. So the major parties there have got a significant advantage. Where they probably will do quite well is in the Senate. So the proportional representation system in the Senate makes it a lot easier for them to get elected. But also, I think in this election, we'll probably see a much higher level of split ticket voting, people voting for different parties between the House of Representatives and the Senate. And I think that will certainly happen to a significant extent among older people. So the issue of increased taxation by Labour on assets, a lot of people don't really want to vote for one or other of the major parties in the Senate, and they'll try and block it by voting for independents. What we find in the last federal election was round about 20%, about one in five people split their tickets between the House of Representatives and the Senate. That's down from 26% in 2013. Some of that was due to the changes in the electoral system that in the Senate that the government introduced. But I think in this election, probably what we'll find is there'll be a significant increase in split ticket voting.
Those electoral system changes you mentioned, though, for Senate voting, this will be the first half Senate election where they apply, and they might bite quite hard, mightn't they?
Potentially they could, but we really didn't see that at the last election, and we can't envisage that that would be all that significant at the next election. We have looked at that in a lot of detail in the surveys. We've also gone over the electoral data. The government took the view that by changing voting above the line in Senate elections, that this was going to undercut minor party candidates and independents getting elected. And really, we didn't see that until 2016. So I think it's unlikely that it's going to significantly affect the minor party and independent vote at the next election.
Some of these people that are either in minor parties or micro parties or independent seem very different in the House than the Senate, don't they? In the Senate, they seem more at the extreme ends, whereas in the House, you at least the ones that are being talked up are more community candidates and more centrist candidates. Is that a valid distinction?
I think that is a valid distinction. It probably reflects the different electoral systems you've got between the two houses. So in the House of Representatives, for somebody to be elected, they effectively have to be a representative of the community. They have to have very strong links to the electorate and so on. In the Senate, they're really representing a whole state or territory, so they can be much more broad, they can be more extreme, they can be all sorts of different things, and that really won't significantly affect whether they're elected or not. Also, what we find for a lot of the minor party candidates who get elected in the House, they tend to have had links in the past with the major parties. I mean, it's one of the characteristics, not just in Australia, but in a lot of other Westminster democracies. So they've quite often gained a profile with a major political party, left that political party, and then they've continued on building on their community links.
Some commentators are saying that Australia is having a populist moment in terms of policies and personalities. Do you think that's right? Do you think we are seeing the populist movement that characterises overseas systems?
Probably two parts to that question. At one level, we do see it in the sense of declining trust in politicians. We see declining satisfaction with democracy, and that's very much in line with what we find in a variety of other countries where there's been a populist surge, the United States, France, certainly the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom, Germany, various other countries. So within the wider electorate, you do see these really quite fundamental changes in public opinion, which we would call secular in the sense that they're not related to whichever political parties in government. They're really people rebelling against both major political parties. But the second part of that is that we don't see it reflected in elections or in the proportion of people who get actually elected to the House of Representatives and the Senate, insofar as the electoral system provides a very significant barrier to that. Now, part of it is to do with the majoritarian system in the House of Representatives, but it's also to do with compulsory voting in the sense that we get 90%+ of the population that turn out on a regular basis to vote, and they use a party heuristic to guide their vote. So they're quite attached to party labels. So once the election comes along, they're still more than likely to vote for one or other of the major political parties. Now, that's not to say that we won't see a significant populist surge in the future, but the history of major political parties in Australia is that they're very adept at incorporating various challenges to their position over time. So if there is a populist surge, say, for example, in the Senate the next election, I would be very surprised to find if the major political parties didn't absorb those particular issues and take account of the concerns of voters and then regain their position at the election afterwards.
We've seen Labor with a long-term lead in the run-up to this election. On the basis of what's happened in the past, would you expect the polls to tighten as we go into the formal campaign?
Polls always do tighten, and not just in Australia, but in a variety of other countries. We see a lot of volatility maybe a year out from an election, and then the fortunes of the major political parties tend to converge. The polls have been so consistent in showing a lead for Labour over a really long period of time, I would find it very difficult to imagine that that could be overturned at any time in the next 2 to 3 months. And building on that, what we've seen is a disaffection among Liberal Party core supporters. Now, part of that is to do with changes in assets and superannuation and so on, which has annoyed a significant minority of Liberal voters, but we've also seen a change in leadership. And we've seen, by and large, a government that's not necessarily been looking after its core base. And I think that's something which is probably the thing that's going to affect Liberal fortunes at the next election.
One issue that you've been asking about over the years is leadership, and you've measured people's attitudes to various leaders. The polls show us, as well as Labor leading, that Bill Shorten is very unpopular and is always unpopular. How do you read this? Why do you think he is having so much trouble establishing a positive image in the mind of voters?
That's always very difficult to determine. We ask a lot of questions in our surveys about personal qualities of leaders. So Bill Shorten ranks below any leader we've ever recorded across virtually every personal quality, including things like trust, competence, integrity, and so on. Very difficult to determine that. One factor might be his trade union background. So he's a bit unlike Hawke or Simon Crean in the sense that he didn't build a very positive profile of himself while he was a trade union leader. It's also the case that he's not seen as a strategic leader by a lot of people. Now he's got quite competent people with him in the shadow cabinet. And
what's a strategic leader?
Well, pushing forward a whole vision. I mean, I don't see a huge vision that he personally is pushing.
And yet there. He has a large bag of policies, as you were talking about before.
Yes, that's correct. But I don't think, for the ordinary voter, I don't think a lot of this is cut through to their image of the leaders. But it's probably worth saying that the crop of leaders we've had over the last 10 years have been nothing like the ratings that leaders have, say, had in the 1980s, 1990s. Now, the interesting question there is it the case that the leaders we've got these days tend to be rated, are simply not as good as the leaders we had 20, 30 years ago? Or is it because voters have become more critical and their expectations are greater? Now, that's more of a methodological question for people that run surveys like myself rather than a substantive question. But it's an interesting fact. I mean, do voters more like to be critical of what leaders do, or the leaders are not as competent?
Is one factor in this the changing media landscape, that leaders are more exposed more of the time to the electorate, and the electorate simply loses patience more quickly?
Well, certainly what we've seen over the last 20, 30 years has been this increasing personalisation of politics. And that's been driven by the visual media, particularly television and so on. But it's also the case that certainly voters like this, because they can hold a leader accountable rather than an abstract thing like a political party. But the political parties like it themselves because they can get their message across much more effectively through a leader than through, say, something like a policy statement. And of course, leaders themselves like it. very much, because they can appeal over the heads of their political parties to the wider electorate. And good examples of that were Tony Blair and so on issues like Iraq and Britain and so on. He really appealed over the heads of his political party colleagues and so on to mobilise the wider electorate. So it's certainly the case that there's very significant changes going on in terms of how we view leaders. But whether it's simply the way we view leaders and what we expect them to do, or whether or not the whole process of elite recruitment is breaking down in the sense that we're not recruiting the quality of leaders we had in the past, I don't know the answer to that.
Just finally, what do you think is the central thing that voters will want out of this election? Is it a policy thing, or is it that they'll want a better system of government generally?
I think it's certainly the case that voters will want a degree of stability. So they've seen a lot of changes in leadership. There's been quite dramatic changes within both of the major political parties. But what we also see, particularly in the ANU poll that we run 3 to 4 times a year, when we ask an open-ended question to people, and we ask them what is the most important problem facing the country, we get a significant number of people say good government. So what they're saying is not just health, education, immigration, the top three issues. They quite often say we want good government. And there's a feeling out there in the electorate, reflected in things like declining trust in politicians, that the institutions of government are not working on their behalf. And I think what really needs to happen after the next election, there needs to be a national debate about redesigning electoral institutions and political institutions so they operate more along the lines of what voters actually want, rather than what political parties want, which is really what we've had in the past.
Ian McAllister, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all from our Conversation Politics podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back again with you soon. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.